It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio once again, Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning.
No job this morning. He is a little bit sick this morning. He ate something that didn't agree with him, which unfortunately happens pretty frequently when you don't have much of an immune system like he.
Yeah, so I tried to crawl back out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of things that crawl, let's talk about a little local group that most people don't know much about because
yes.
the media doesn't really cover them.
Yes, not until they actually do something like sink a major transportation package. We talked a couple of weeks ago on this program about the Regional Transportation Investment District. That's the three county area. That's representatives from city councils and county councils from the three county area of Pierce, King, and Snohomish County. They've been given the task by the state legislature to come up with a transportation package that would go on the ballot. It was supposed to go on the ballot about a year and a half ago, but delays in agreeing on what bits of transportation infrastructure should be in the package has held it back. And this spring, they finally came to some agreement on what should be in the transportation package, and a mix of a mix of taxes and fees that would fund the transportation package. But as we talked about when I explained it a little while back, the funders, a group of major businesses in the area, including Boeing, Microsoft, and Vulcan, would have to look at the package and decide whether or not they wanted to fund a campaign to advertise this package to get voters to come out and vote for it in the fall. The funders reviewed the package, did a little poll this past month, and they have decided that no, they will not support the package. So now it's not going to the voters at all. So I thought folks should know that one of the reasons we're not getting anything done as far as transportation in the region isn't so much that it's the politicians that are delaying, because, well, they are delaying, but even when they do reach an agreement, it's also the big business interests in the region who have to approve it long before the voters even get a look.
So I just want to point out to people listening, the group, the funders, that's how they put it in the newspaper. It sounds, I mean, if you were just listening to it, you'd assume these people are like funding the project or something like that. But read it in newspapers,
no.
Funders with a capital F. You know, and in I think
they're funding the advertising campaign for the ballot initiative. That's why they're called the funders.
Right. But they're the people that seem to have more say in this than either our elected officials or the citizens.
Yeah, they get the ultimate veto over whether something will go on the ballot or not, and they have vetoed the current project, particularly because of the gas tax and the sales tax portions of it.
So, sounds like a group we need to find out a little more about.
Or maybe somehow take them out of the equation. That would be good.
All right. Moving along, some good news this week regarding Kyoto and the Kyoto.
Yes, the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty was set to go into effect as soon as the nation of Russia would ratify it. Russia would provide the final okay in order for the treaty to have enough countries and enough of the world's population adhering to the treaty for it to go into effect as international law. Russia had delayed, saying that it would be that would have a huge impact on their economy and be, I think the term they used was economic Auschwitz for their nation. But analysts who were watching that said that they thought maybe Russia was just using it as a bargaining chip to try and get some European nations to give in on trade talks. And in fact, that's what happened this week. European Union came to a trade deal with Russia, and then Vladimir Putin did an immediate 180 reversal and said, okay, we'll ratify Kyoto now. So the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty will come into effect and become international law. However, the United States has not ratified it, and the Bush administration has said that they will not adhere to the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty. So, as usual, the rest of the world will be moving on in a progressive direction while the United States continues to backslide. So there, that is a bit of good news that Kyoto will be going into effect. However, it's tempered by the fact that it won't have any bearing on what we do here in the U.S.
Yeah, international treaties don't seem a very high priority for the
The Bush administration or U.S. business interests, no.
So, moving along, last week you talked about the world's largest democracy, which for some people will come as a surprise, is not the United States.
No. It's India. India had its elections in the past month. It actually went over the course of several weeks voting in different areas of India. And as we reported last week, the Congress Party, which is headed by Sonia Gandhi and her niece and nephew, won out over the BJP party, a group of nationalist, Hindu nationalist folks who have been running the country for the last several years. Now, the Congress Party didn't have an outright majority in Parliament, so they had to form a coalition government in order to rule. And in their coalition government is a socialist party and two much smaller communist parties. Now, as soon as the Congress Party announced the makeup of the coalition, the Indian stock market crashed. And the main reason the Indian stock market crashed was because foreign investors pulled up somewhere around... Well, foreign investors have $7 to $8 billion of investments in the Indian stock market, and they pulled out their investments in India in massive amounts, and that's what led to the crash of the Indian stock market. Sonia Gandhi was therefore had to decline becoming the new prime minister of India, and instead she nominated for her party, and her party has then improved a man named Manmohan Singh. He was the architect of India's privatization program in the early 1990s. So here you have a situation of Indian voters, particularly poor rural voters, having elected the Congress Party to take over the country, approximately because they have been really frustrated with the BJP and its conservative economic policies and its movement to privatize Indian state industries and to give money and support to wealthy Indians at the expense of poor Indians. And then you have the Congress Party coming into power, and because foreign investors voted with their dollars, they have to then give the control of the country over to someone who really set the groundwork for much of the work that the BJP had done in the past few years as far as opening up investments, opening up Indian investments to foreign investors, which really has led to this problem, and privatizing most of the Indian state assets, like control of their oil and control of their banking industry and their insurance industry, et cetera.
So we're seeing where the dollar votes count more than the citizen votes there as well.
Yeah. Actually, that I would say that's a good estimation of what happened this past week.
Any insight into why Sonia Gandhi would hand it over, to this former BJP person and not maybe make more of a compromise move, somebody that wasn't quite so involved with the previous engineering of the situation?
No, I think she clearly recognized what was going on. There were news reports saying that she stepped down because the BJP had complained that you can't allow a foreign-born person, Sonia Gandhi was born in Italy, to run the country. However, that's not really what was going on. She recognized immediately that it had to do that financial markets had to be stabilized, and that it had to do with the fact that there were socialists and communists inside of her government. She had to choose someone that was as far from that as possible, and she chose Manmohan Singh.
All right, but will the Congress Party still be in charge? I mean, even with this other person.
In order to get a majority in Parliament, a majority vote in Parliament, they will have to make compromises with the Socialist Party and the Communist Parties that are part of their coalition, and they will have to, on some votes, probably make compromises with the BJP as well. So I think what they were looking at was, well, even though socialists and communists are part of our coalition, as far as the economy is concerned, we're really, the Congress Party really does sort of follow the BJP's lead. They have never, I mean, they have said that, yeah, the privatization program is going too quickly, et cetera. There needs to be more benefits for poor Indians. But I think overall that they lean more closely towards the BJP view. And so in appointing Singh, they said, she's really saying, look, yeah, when we need a major economic vote in Parliament, we're going to be courting the BJP. We're not going to be courting our other coalition members.
And finally, last question on that, the money that pulled out there, any idea, is it like the usual international investors
way of
tracking that?
Yeah, and we're not talking about just American investors. We're talking about European investors, wealthy investors from all over the world. India really opened up its economy for foreign investment in about 1993, and Singh was one of the people who laid the groundwork for that, but the BJP really oversaw it. So, yeah, it's basically, you know, wealthy foreign investors who poured their money in the mid-1990s, and now they're saying, oh my gosh, we can't let it go backwards, and oh my gosh, you know, you can't let any of the profits from the sale of Indian assets go towards the poor people of India, and gosh, wealthy people and businesses should not have to pay taxes, so we're going to leave. That's pretty much what was going on.
All right. Well, moving on. Just when you think things can't get any worse in Palestine, Israel, this week's news takes a turn exactly in that direction.
Yeah, in the past couple of weeks, the Israeli military has made a major incursion into the Gaza Strip, particularly the town and the refugee camp of Rafah at the very southern tip of the Gaza Strip. And there have been a number of house demolitions which have come under attack by human rights groups and governments all over the world as a violation of the Geneva Conventions and violations of international law. It's really a form of collective punishment. And the main cause of the incursion into Gaza is that Israeli military, a small number of Israeli military troops came under ambush nearby and were killed a couple of weeks ago. And so tanks rolled into the Gaza Strip and occupied portions of the Rafah camp, and then went around with these armored bulldozers and started demolishing homes pretty much randomly. Now, some of the homes that were demolished were homes that belonged to families of people suspected of having been suicide bombers. That's a form of collective punishment that is prohibited by international law. Some of the houses that were destroyed were neighbors' homes. Other houses were destroyed simply or apparently for no reason. Now, some other things were going on as well. Witnesses say that Israeli tanks moved through the refugee camp and said over loudspeakers that all men over the age of 16 had to come out of their homes and collect at nearby schools and public meeting places, or else their houses would be demolished. That also is a form of collective punishment and detention that is prohibited by international law. And then this past week, just a couple of days ago, about 1,000 or so demonstrators marched from the nearby town of Rafah towards the refugee camp, bringing aid to people an estimate of about 1,000 people who've been displaced by the home demolitions. And on the way to the refugee camp, an Israeli tank and helicopters opened fire on the demonstration and killed at least 10 people, the majority of whom were children. Now, this is also coming under a lot of international condemnation. The UN Security Council took a vote on whether or not to condemn Israeli actions this week in the Rafah refugee camp. And believe it or not, the U.S. usually vetoes these kinds of resolutions. The U.S. actually abstained and allowed the resolution to pass. That's how bad Israel's actions have been this week. Yet the U.S. again has refused, to condemn the actions. And as we all know, it's U.S. military aid that allows Israel to continue to buy its tanks and its helicopters and to buy bullets for Israeli guns that are then turned on Palestinians. So it really is what the U.S. government says to Israel, to the Israeli government, that makes a difference. And this week, the Bush administration refused to outright condemn these actions. So there is something that we can do, and that's to express our disgust with the U.S. government not standing with international law and calling for Israel to stop these kinds of house demolitions and attacks on unarmed demonstrators.
All right. Well, moving along to this week in Iraq, further examples of what our tax dollars are purchasing, similar to the situation in Palestine, Israel.
Yeah, there were more revelations this week on in the Iraqi prisoner abuse scandal. Now, there were soldiers and also released detainees who talked about some of the other abuses that are going on in other places, not just in Abu Ghraib. And there was actually an NBC News report, I believe it was just yesterday, that the Delta Force, the Army's elite Delta Force, is now being investigated by the Pentagon Inspector General for abuses at a secret detention facility near the Baghdad airport, which may, it turns out, make Abu Ghraib look like Sesame Street, some of the tortures that are alleged to be going on there. Higher-ups at the Pentagon and civilians in the Bush administration, it turns out, have given the okay for many of these interrogation procedures. Now, there was a memo leaked from Alberto Gonzalez, who is the White House counsel for the Bush for the White House for George Bush and his administration, that was sent to the president, and it talked about the legal ramifications of not treating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees as prisoners of war. This is, as you can guess, an older memo. It came out before the Iraq War, but it really set the groundwork for the treatment of all prisoners, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And I'm just going to quote a little bit from the memo. It's really clear from reading it that they understood early on what some of the ramifications of not adhering to the Geneva Conventions could do. Under the negative implications, he lists that it could undermine U.S. military culture, which emphasizes maintaining the highest standards of conduct in combat, and could introduce an element of uncertainty in the status of adversaries. So there he's talking about the potential for the abuse of prisoners and torture of detainees. Now, Gonzalez says later on in the memo, quote, "The argument based on military culture fails to recognize that our military remain bound to apply the principles of the Geneva Convention because that is what you have directed them to do." And he's addressing that to President Bush. Now, he's right about that, except there are other people involved in the military chain of command, and they may direct the U.S. military personnel to do other things. And that's what's been leaking out this week, is that some of the other superiors, military superiors at the Pentagon, have been directing the people who were in control of the Abu Ghraib prison and other detention facilities to do other things besides adhere to the Geneva Conventions. Now, the New York Times reported this week that Colonel Thomas Pappas, the man who controlled the interrogators at the Abu Ghraib prison, was under enormous pressure from his superiors to collect more information from the detainees and to use suspect techniques in order to do so. Now, who were his superiors? His superiors included Major General Barbara Fast, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, you may remember his name, we talked about him last week, and Major General Jeffrey Miller. We also talked about him last week. He had been in charge of the Guantanamo facility and then was brought over to Iraq in order to up the stakes in interrogations at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in Iraq. Now, this week, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez testified before Congress, and so did Major General Jeffrey Miller, that they didn't give the okay for any of these torture techniques that were used at Abu Ghraib. But the New York Times quoted a senior officer who worked with Colonel Pappas as saying that he would emerge from his meetings with Sanchez, quote, clutching his face as if in pain. And he likened it to a root canal without Novocaine. These intense meetings that he had with Lieutenant General Sanchez about how to extract information from the detainees at Abu Ghraib. So it was pretty clear that Sanchez was saying, come on, you got to use tougher techniques. So even though Sanchez said he never gave the okay, particularly the written okay, for the use of dogs to terrorize prisoners, for stripping prisoners naked, for withholding food, and some of these humiliation techniques that were used, that it may be he gave the verbal okay, or at least said in general terms that he wanted Pappas to use much more severe techniques. Now, that does put the blame squarely in his court, and it begs the question of who at the Pentagon and who high up in the Bush administration was leaning on Sanchez. Now, the Washington Post also reported that top U.S. military officials in Iraq, including Sanchez, signed a memo on August 18, 2003, calling for interrogators to take control of the living conditions of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Military interrogators and CIA interrogators and independent contractors who were interrogators, not the military police, were in control of Abu Ghraib. And that included getting control of the lighting, heat, food, and clothing, or lack thereof, for the prisoners at all times. Now, worse things have been leaking out as some of the prisoners have been released. Some hundreds of prisoners are being released from Abu Ghraib, and some soldiers are coming forward to talk. There have been descriptions of much worse tortures going on at the jails, not just at Abu Ghraib, but at other detention facilities, and it includes people being beaten to death, the rape of female and male prisoners, although when a U.S. military soldier has sex with a female detainee, it is often described as having sex with a female detainee. It's not called rape, as it should be called, although when a male U.S. soldier has sex with a male detainee, it is called rape. I'm just pointing that out just as an example of more sexism within the military. Some of the other tortures included mock executions, and as I described last week, water torture is alleged to have been used and being used at the detention facility near the Baghdad airport. Now, going on to speak of some of the low standards of conduct in combat, to sort of take a phrase from Gonzalez's memo, the U.S. military this week killed 42 members of a wedding party in western Iraq this week. The Pentagon says that they were bombing foreign fighters who were hiding in a safe house in the desert, and that those foreign fighters had fired on U.S. troops. However, there were reporters with cameras nearby who rushed to the scene and recorded the aftermath of the attack. And what they found were 11 dead women, 14 dead children, the youngest was a one-year-old baby, and 17 dead men, not all of whom were combat age, as the Pentagon claimed. Witnesses at the site all told the same story, that it was a wedding in a small border village in the desert, that no one had fired on U.S. troops, and that U.S. helicopters and planes had been checking out the village for hours before the attack, and that sometime in the middle of the night at about 3 in the morning, U.S. planes just suddenly attacked the village. Now, the Pentagon said, yes, but we found jewelry, guns, $1,000 in Iraqi dinars, we found sport utility vehicles, we found pickup trucks, foreign passports, and satellite communications equipment. The witnesses then turned around and said, yeah, we had all that. It was a wedding, so women brought their jewelry. Sport utility vehicles and pickup trucks are the preferred vehicles for farmers and herders in western Iraq. Everyone in Iraq carries a gun, especially in the lawless border region. There are no phone lines out here, and of course there are no phone lines in the western desert, so of course the village would have bought a satellite phone, a single satellite phone. That's the satellite equipment that they found. And of course, the Syrian passports belong to our relatives who came from a village a few miles across the border to attend the wedding. Now, and of course, the cash, the $1,000 in cash, was going to be used to pay the band and the wedding singers. Now, by the way, broken musical instruments were found in the rubble, and a lot of women's clothing and so forth were also found in the bombed rubble of the houses in the village. Now, the main questions are, why did U.S. troops bomb and murder these people, regardless of who they are? Why didn't they go in and try to capture them if they were foreign fighters for the intelligence? You know, at least some of them. You know, I mean, they could have gone in and tried to capture at least some of them. Why didn't U.S. soldiers who examined the site after the attack, excuse me, arrest any of the survivors if they thought it was a way station for foreign fighters sneaking into the country? And then, why didn't they report to their commanding officers that there were so many dead children? And we're not talking about teenagers here. We're talking about 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, little kids who were killed in the bombing raid. So I think that's an example of how attitudes high up in the Pentagon and the Bush administration are influencing decisions on the ground, and they're setting a very, very, very low standard of conduct in this war. Now, the film of the aftermath of the Wedding Massacre can be added to the photos of the Iraqi prison abuse and added to videotaped footage of intense fighting in Karbala and Najaf this week in persuading the Arab community that the U.S. is not interested in bringing democracy to Iraq but is interested in destroying the country and pursuing a war that is targeting Islam. Now, you have to live in the Middle East in order to see the intense fighting that's going on in Karbala and Najaf, because American reporters and Western reporters from other news agencies are holed up in Baghdad in terror. None of them want to leave Baghdad because of what happened to Nicholas Berg, the civilian contractor who was beheaded, and what has happened to other Westerners who have been kidnapped and held for ransom, some of them killed, some of them released in Iraq. So that means that most of the reporters who are getting the scoop on what's going on in southern Iraq are Arab-speaking people and Iraqi reporters, and the news and the video footage is going out to Arab news stations, and it is going out to Arab wire services, and the whole Middle East is seeing this. So that means that you and I here in the U.S. are not getting a clear view of what's going on in Iraq, while the Middle East is. And they are seeing the war for what it is. Now, this week, Shiites all over the Middle East protested over what's been going on in Najaf and Karbala. There were thousands that marched in Bahrain. They overturned police cars, set them on fire, and demanded that the U.S. military pull out of Najaf and Karbala. Tens of thousands demonstrated in Lebanon, and in Iran, there were violent protests outside the British embassy. The U.S. doesn't have an embassy in Iran, but Britain does. And some of the demonstrators there threw Molotov cocktails at the embassy in an attempt to try to set it on fire. Now, remember, the Bush administration originally invaded Iraq in order to set up a democracy that would be an example for the rest of the Middle East. However, Iraq has become a different kind of example for the rest of the Middle East, as we're seeing. And I just want to mention at the very end, it looks like the Pentagon's friend, Ahmed Chalabi, is getting his allowance cut off and his room searched this week in Iraq. And one of the reasons for why the Pentagon has finally turned on their favorite son is that Ahmed Chalabi has been behaving very badly, asking for the U.S. to turn over Iraq's oil assets to the new interim government. He's been demanding that the governing council have a role in governing the country past June 30th. And he also wants them to have control of the Iraqi police and military, all things that the U.S. government does not want to do. And so they figure it's time to turn on their old buddy and to cut off the funding and to try to find some way to discredit him. And that's what's been happening this week in Iraq.
All right. So they'll be looking for someone new on the playground to take over that position, I assume.
That's right.
Well, with that, we're out of time. Talking once again with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State at bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications around town. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to volunteer, our phone number is 206-903-9461. And we are starting a new pledge drive for Eat the State to try and bring in few thousand dollars in donations so that we can pay off our printer bill. So I'd like folks to pay attention to that and to help us out by sending in checks so that we can reach our goal. I believe our goal is set at $5,000 or $6,000 to try to help pay off our printer bill. So donations are very, very welcome.
And I understand you're also looking for a couple of distributors in the
Belltown
area.
Yes, we're also looking for volunteers to do distribution on Capitol Hill and in downtown Belltown. So if that sounds like something you'd like to do, take papers around and drop them off at places in those neighborhoods, give us a call at 206-903-9461.